turn right. Oh, down the lane.
Wait, wait,
no, no, no.
Okay,
get the procedure. Just get out the lane.
Truck. Locked it every turn.
You're blaming me for the traffic?
Should I?
Mark, slow down.
You want to ride behind somebody who does something like that?
Don't lean
Stupid.
On the horn.
Is that what you said? Huh?
I think it's time to discuss road rage.
We have all experienced some level of that road rage living here in LA. More about the impact traffic has on our mental and physical health later in the show. First, though, a Coast Guard lieutenant who was arrested last week had plans to kill a long list of prominent Democratic politicians and high-profile journalists. His name is Lieutenant Christopher Paul Hassan, a self-described white nationalist. In a letter he wrote, obtained by federal prosecutors, he wrote, "I am dreaming of a way to kill almost every last person on the earth." Hassan served in the military, first in the Marine Corps, and then a few years on active duty in the Army National Guard. Joining us to talk about the connection between the military, white supremacy, and violence is Charlotte Clymer, military veteran, now press secretary for the LGBTQ civil rights group, the Human Rights Campaign. Welcome to you, Charlotte.
Hey, how you doing?
Great, thanks. Also joining us, Dave Phillips, who is covering the story for The New York Times. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Let's begin with you. What do we know about this plot that Hassan allegedly had? What was his goal?
Well, we know that he's a Coast Guard lieutenant, a career guy who's served for 28 years, first in the Marines, then National Guard, finally the Coast Guard, where he kind of had a desk job doing acquisitions, essentially supply and purchasing for ships. But while he was sitting at his desk, supposedly doing Coast Guard work, he was also plotting this vast, almost crazy plan to try and figure out how to start a race war. He was considering, you know, how to find biological agents like botulism or anthrax that he could use to kill people. He's trying to figure out how he could use already existing tensions between various groups to you know, create schisms that would lead to violence. And he was stockpiling guns, ammunition, and drugs that he hoped would you know, let him make it all happen.
Right. And this was based on allegedly the manifesto that Norwegian shooter Anders Breivik has written, a 1,500-page manifesto outlining what people like him could do to start a race war.
Right. Hassan seems like he was a bit of a fan of Mr. Breivik, who killed, I believe, nearly 80 people in 2011. Before he did the shooting, he released this long and detailed manifesto that described both his motivations and how other people should carry out that type of violence if they wanted to. And his goal was to overthrow what he saw as overly permissive and liberal governments that were a threat, essentially, to the white race.
Hmm. Charlotte, let's bring you in here. You've written on Twitter a long thread about how Hassan's training in the Marine Corps, in the military in general, is alarming in a way that this kind of training would prepare someone who would be predisposed to this kind of thinking to carry out a violent act.
That's right. I mean, when you go in the military, you are trained extensively on how to kill people. You know, that's what someone in the military does. It's the art of war and engaging in warfare. And the problem comes when there's not a reasonable accountability over that, when you get into civilian life. In 2009, Homeland Security released a report warning about the recruitment of veterans by white supremacist groups. And they clearly stated that this could lead to you know, terrorist attacks down the road. The FBI identified something like 203 white supremacists among, 203 veterans in white supremacist groups who had extensive military training. So this is a recurring theme that we've seen, and it's not really been talked about enough. You know, we need to ensure that we have some kind of proper accountability over the skills that the military provides for these folks when they get into the civilian world.
Mm-hmm. And what did you see personally when you were in the military? Did you see any examples of white supremacy, white nationalism?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, all the time. You know, it's not something that is very fun to talk about for anyone. I mean, I greatly am proud of my military service, and I am proud of the military in general, but there's definitely a strain of folks who enter the military with incredibly racist beliefs. You know, there were folks in my own unit who would, you know, at times use the N-word or express values in line with white supremacy. Sometimes they were counseled, sometimes it was ignored. But this is far, far, far more common than the average American realizes. And it's not something that I think military leadership has done enough to hold accountable.
One of the militia, one of the leaders of one of these groups in Charlottesville, it was a member of the military.
That's right. Yeah. And they have significant influence over the folks who are not in the military. You know, the civilians who have racist beliefs but never served are pretty susceptible to being influenced by the veterans who come out of service and, you know, enter one of these, you know, radical groups that seeks to impose white supremacist beliefs on the population.
And Dave, what do we know about whether or not Hassan was under any kind of suspicion when he was working either at the Coast Guard or
you
earlier?
You know, let me interject and say that I disagree with the line of thinking here. I absolutely think that there are white supremacists in the military. But I think that the military is a reflection of our society as a whole. And in the case of Lieutenant Hassan, we don't know enough yet to draw any lines between his service and whether it predisposed him to what he is alleged to have done. But he doesn't have seemed to have seen anything, you know, like combat. And we don't even know if he was in a combat arms profession in the military. He could have been a desk jockey his whole life. So I want listeners to be really careful to draw lines. It's tempting, but I don't think we know enough yet to say that.
Right.
Well, I do. I definitely know that. And I don't mean to be disrespectful in saying that, but, you know, there is a major problem within the military of racism that goes unchecked. And you're right. We don't know what his beliefs were before entering the military. We certainly don't know if he was in a combat arms job during the Marine Corps. But regardless, folks who enlist and go through military training are taught how to kill. And those skills stay with them throughout life. I've been getting messages all day from other veterans who are really glad that people are talking about this finally, because it is something that I think a lot of civilians all too easily gloss over. It's discomforting, right? It's discomforting to think that, you know, our veterans who we revere, some of them have extremely violent beliefs.
The DHS report did warn that right-wing groups were recruiting veterans, and the FBI has said something similar. But that report, I guess, had, you know, was shelved at the time because there was a big outcry over it.
We it is very, very uncomfortable for us to consider that, you know, folks in the military who are supposed to be our, you know, best and brightest, and many of them are. You know, I think most folks in the military really are the best our country has to offer, but there's a lot of folks who are not. And kind of use this training down the road to do things that are against everything we stand for.
Right. And I guess the most obvious and extreme example of that would be the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing.
That's right. Timothy McVeigh. Yeah. He was a former soldier. You also have Lee Harvey Oswald, who committed, you know, assassinated JFK. But, you know, more recent examples. Last year, there was a veteran who shot up a veteran's home, killed three healthcare workers there. Another Marine veteran killed 12 people in a nightclub. I mean, these are things that happen more often than we would like to we care to admit. But when they do pop up, it seems like they have a very, very short shelf life on the news cycle.
Yeah. And Dave, just in this particular case, so I guess Hassan's public defender is saying that, look, it's not a she said it's not a crime to think negative thoughts. It's not a crime to think doomsday scenarios. So is it going to be tough for prosecutors to get this detention until trial that they're pushing for, given the amount of evidence that we have right now?
So he was arrested on relatively minor charges of illegal possession of weapons and drugs. And he has been, a judge just recently, within the last few hours, granted his detention for another 12 or 14 days. During that time, the judge said the prosecution could file more charges, and my suspicion is that they will. You know, whenever you are foiling a plot before it happens, it is a lot harder to get a conviction because everything is, you know, hasn't happened yet, right?
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, we can breathe easy that the authorities are able to do this and they do act swiftly. So we'll see what they decide to file. We're getting hints that they monitored his both his work computer, which is where I believe this whole case started, and his home computer. They've seized a number of things from his home. I wouldn't be surprised if they have their pick of things they can charge him with. His defense attorney says, on the other hand, like, look, here's a guy who was Googling some pretty scary stuff, but that is not a crime in the United States. And he served 28 years. He's got a wife and kids. Let him go. So far, the judge was not convinced.
All right, we'll leave it there. Dave Phillips, national correspondent for The New York Times. Charlotte Clymer, military veteran and press secretary for Human Rights Campaign. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Coming up, the allure of hipster evangelical churches, Hillsong, Zoe, and why celebrities like Chris Pratt are adherents. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
There's this great quote that I actually heard in church, and it felt like it really appropriate, which was, if the spotlight that's shining on you is brighter than the light that comes from within you, it'll kill you.
That's Chris Pratt talking about his faith on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert last week. He's a member of Zoe Church in L.A., which is part of a new evangelical movement. That movement led by the Hillsong Church. Well, Ellen Page later called Pratt out on Twitter. She said his church is famously anti-gay. Many celebrities are attracted to these churches, to Hillsong in particular, Justin Bieber, Kendall Jenner, Kevin Durant. And regular people are members, too. More than 100,000 around the world attend services every week. Well, here to talk about the rise of these hipster evangelicals is Richard Florey, Senior Director of Research and Evaluation at USC Center for Religion and Civic Culture. Hi there.
Hi there.
And we're also joined by Leah Cesarine. She is an ex-member of Hillsong in New York. Hi.
Hi there.
Okay, Leah, let's start with you. What attracted you to Hillsong in the first place?
Yeah, so one of my really good friends from college introduced me to the church. He invited me to come to one of their services when the church was relatively small in New York. And, you know, it was just a young, hip church filled with people who looked like me, dressed like me. It was super inviting. The music was, you know, entertaining. And the messaging was pretty broad and, you know, made a lot of references to New York City culture. So it was really appealing for me.
And how old were you at the time?
I was about 19.
Okay. So, Richard, is that a common description that these kinds of churches attract young, I'm assuming millennials in Leah's case, or mm-hmm. urbanites who are looking for some kind of connection and may not find it in a traditional church?
Yeah, what we've observed, and we've talked to a lot of people, the first time I went to Hillsong, I felt so out of it. I mean, I was so much older than everybody else. And so, yeah, it's exactly what she said. It's younger skewing. It's highly professional and polished worship service and music, completely with lights and fog machines and things like that. And so it's very appealing to a younger crowd.
How did it start out?
Well, it started in Australia, and it's part of a larger denomination, but in reality, it's its own group, and it has now churches all around the world, I think 13 or 14 different countries and multiple locations in these countries. In the U.S., this got the New York Church, the Los Angeles Church, the San Francisco Church, and these are all relatively new in terms of that global reach. And so it comes out of a Pentecostal background. Which is generally conservative theologically, generally conservative on cultural issues, but they've tapped this sort of edgy cultural vibe where people want to go there.
So, Leah, did you know that it was based on this Pentecostal conservative ideology?
Initially, I had no idea. I mean, the messaging, like I said, was pretty broad, and there was nothing really specific about any of their values that struck me as super conservative. And I think that the whole aesthetic of it was so hip and progressive that it was pretty deceiving.
Pretty deceiving. So when did you finally see it actually wasn't as hip and progressive as it made out itself out to be?
I think when I started to talk aloud with some of the people, the friends that I had made at the church, and kind of question some of the values, like, you know, sex before marriage or gay couples, you know, and talk about the controversy that also happened with the founder, where he made a pretty like anti-gay statement. So, yeah, that was when I started to raise an eyebrow.
Mm-hmm. And you did you begin investigating and looking into it more deeply?
I didn't really at the time because I was pretty young. I kind of just left and didn't really question it any further.
Richard, so what are their beliefs when it comes to these social issues that Leah just mentioned? Sex before marriage, gay couples, abortion. What's the official stance?
Yeah, well, I would say that they're solidly in the world of evangelical morals and values. And that would be you don't have sex before marriage. They would be pro-life. They're not going to be on board with gay marriage and things like that. However, what I will say in a lot of these churches, partly because they're so big and partly because of the kinds of people that are attracted to them, and I know they would not frame it exactly this way, but essentially it's a don't ask, don't tell environment. And so people are able to go, and we see this across the board in multiple kinds of projects that we've done, particularly with younger people, is that people are able to go and get what they want and ignore the rest. And the rest of it, they don't really worry about. And in fact, in the Sunday services, and Leah just mentioned this, you don't really pick up on these larger kinds of cultural stances that they may have.
Hmm. Is it a kind of love the sinner, hate the sin mentality?
Yeah. I think that would be exactly the way that they would frame it. And in fact, there's a lot of language in the evangelical and Pentecostal world about separating identity from activity on LGBT and sex issues in general. So you can be a particular identity as long as you don't act on it.
So Leah, was that just a bridge too far for you? Like you thought it was too... You couldn't reconcile that?
I mean, it didn't really strike me as alarming at the time, but I think what's really interesting, as you just mentioned, the whole don't ask, don't tell mentality, and that was totally true because it was just this unspoken rule. A lot of the young people that I knew there at the time were all getting married really young, and I was like, okay, you know, there's obviously some reason why they're following these footsteps, you know?
And I'll say another thing about to Leah's point is that there is a huge amount of pressure for these young people. They want to have sex because it's everywhere. And so, unfortunately, the outcome of that often is they will get married much earlier than they should, and then their marriages will fail, and they'll live with all that guilt and stuff over time.
And what is the money factor here? Do you have to tithe? And is somebody getting rich off this?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. Well, first of all, in general, every church, you have to think of every church like a business. You have to have support, and they don't have anything to sell, essentially, and this is a really crass way to say it, but they don't have anything to sell but their services, whatever their services are. It's like coming for the morning service, it's the community, it's the outreach, whatever it is. And in return, people support those ministries. And so they will tithe or they will just give $5 out of their pocket or whatever. But in order to support a church of these sizes, you have to have significant resources. I mean, I don't know what the rent is on the Belasco Theater downtown LA, but I guarantee you it's a lot. I think Zoe Church meets at the Sabin Theater. Mm. In Beverly Hills, that's got to be huge amounts of money. So they have the celebrity quotient, which probably is one source of resources. But for Hillsong, one major source of resource for them is their music. And their music is everywhere in the evangelical and Pentecostal world.
Leah, when you were a member of the church, did you tithe? Did you feel like you had to give a certain amount of money?
I don't think I ever donated any money, but there was a lot of pressure to donate your time. And so on Sunday services, you know, they would really encourage you, okay, you know, volunteer for one service, but the more services you volunteer for on a Sunday, it's like the higher praise you get. And I wouldn't do that. And, you know, I felt a little bit like I couldn't really, you know, I don't know, be accepted because I couldn't donate all of my time. But another interesting point about the music is that they have these conference festivals that are like $150 per ticket that sell out. There's like the Women's Color Conference or something. And I never went to those either.
And I wonder if the celebrities, they donate a significant amount more because they can.
Yeah, that could be that. But they also are an attraction for people to come, too.
Yeah, exactly.
So on the conferences, that's actually something that's really taken off in the last several years, particularly within the Pentecostal world. So from that point of view, there's a huge income stream that comes from these conferences and the kinds of network relationships they have. In fact, more so than they would ever get from their tithing. I mean, one of the concerning things to me about Hillsong, and it partly concerns me because I really want to talk to somebody there, but partly is like, if I'm going to try to go to this church, I want information about it. If you get on their website, you can hardly find out anything.
Hmm. Yeah.
And to get more information, you have to give up more of your personal information. And I find that really disconcerting on a number of levels.
Yeah. And then what are they doing for the community? Are they doing? Are they
well in
food
LA?
Banking, and food, you know, helping the homeless or anything like that.
Yeah, LA is still relatively new, and my hope for them is that they actually do develop stuff. If you get on their website, it looks way better than what's actually going on. But most of what they do is Sunday morning or Saturday night or whatever, and then everybody's gone. And some of it's a function of how they organize themselves. They're in a rented space. But these are transient urban crowds, you know, and so it's not the same as like a neighborhood church or synagogue, you know, where that serves those people in that community. It's just different. In fact, when we were there, I had this working hypothesis that there's probably a core of people that's the only place they go, and they volunteer and do all the stuff that Leah talked about. But the bigger group are the people that come and go, and they have another place that they go to church. Or they don't go to church, and they pop through Hillsong once a month, once every 2 months. And so the attraction is the music, the celebrity, the experience. But the downside of that from this perspective is they never have some sort of community that actually does something in the larger community.
And Leah, finally, do you miss it at all? Do you miss the community? Do you miss the church at all?
No, I don't really. You know, I mean, the friendships that I had there are no longer. I think it was a great experience for me at that time in my life when, you know, I was a vulnerable, early 20-year-old going through things and wanted a sense of community. So it was helpful during the time, but I'm much happier since leaving.
That's Leah Cesarine. She's an ex-member of Hillsong in New York. Richard Florey is Senior Director of Research and Evaluation at USC Center for Religion and Civic Culture. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, what sitting in LA traffic does to people.
They're leaning on their horns, they're banging on their steering wheels. You may not be able to hear them, but you see the anger on their faces and in their gestures.
Road rage and how it affects us mentally and physically, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. We are all victims of LA traffic. Inching from the 405 to the 10 to the 110 to the 101 to the 134 and all over again. Well, it turns out sitting in traffic can do more than just ruin your mood. A study published last year looked at the link between crime and traffic congestion here in LA, and it found that extreme traffic increased the incidence of domestic violence by nearly 10%. Still, More studies show long commutes can have negative effects on your mental health and well-being. So we asked some listeners how they feel after they sit in traffic as part of KCRW's Curious Coast series. Reporter Jenny Hamill is here to share with us what some of them had to say. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
Also joining us is psychotherapist Amy Morin. She's written about the effects your commute can have on your life for Psychology Today. Hi, Amy.
Hello.
Okay, let's begin with you. What does the research say about what traffic and sitting in traffic does to your mental health?
Well, studies have found there's a clear link between the longer your commute is, then the less satisfied you are likely to be with life. And that sitting in traffic, the more time you spend sitting in congested traffic especially, the lower your well-being is and the increased probability that you'll experience mental health problems and higher levels of stress.
So that study that came out about the link between traffic and domestic violence was not surprising to you?
No, it's not really surprising at all. I think that a lot of people end up being extremely stressed out. The more stress that they're under, the more likely they are to have trouble controlling their anger and to have more difficulty controlling their behavior when they get home.
Jenny, I assume you heard similar tales, maybe not the extreme domestic violence part of it, but similar tales of anger from the listeners you talked to.
And I have a quick stat. So INRIX, which is a traffic data company, found that on average last year, we Angelenos spent about 128 hours in traffic. So that's like going to work on a Monday or going in your car and driving in traffic through Saturday morning.
Wow.
With no stops.
Every year.
Every year. So the people that I talk to, I mean, words like angry, agitated, anxious, you know, just needing to unwind. I mean, that's just the common theme for everyone who drives in LA. I spoke to one woman named Jasmine Barcelo, who said she had had an experience the day that we spoke.
Just today, I actually had a doctor's appointment and I almost got sideswiped by some girl on the 101 freeway. And it's a cycle, a vicious cycle of anger and frustration and anger and frustration. And, you know, I have been known to maybe flip the bird a couple of times. Not proud of that, but it happens.
Who hasn't?
Who hasn't? I know.
I mean, maybe not us, but
well, Amy, there's a thing where you feel like that other person is the enemy who's like trying to get ahead of you, and maybe you're someone else's enemy. Why do we become angry, hateful people to other human beings? We would maybe be nice to if we met them, you know, in the grocery store, but once they're driving to and from the grocery store, we hate them.
One reason is because we don't view cars as people. We view them as these sort of objects, and we start to think of them as the enemy, as if we're all in a race to get somewhere. So when somebody cuts in front of you, it seems like they unfairly took advantage of you, and they're putting you at a disadvantage because you're now behind them. And we forget that it's human beings. It's somebody that could be your grandmother, your friend, your neighbor driving the car, and they're just doing the same thing we are. They're just trying to get somewhere. But we lose sight of all of that, and we start to think of that we're in competition with people, and we start thinking, this isn't fair. They shouldn't have cut in front of me. I need to be ahead, or they're putting me back even further. And we sort of dehumanize people when they're sitting behind the wheel.
It's kind of like what we do online when we, you know, go on Twitter or something.
Yeah, it's easier to hate the car rather than the person.
Don't hate the driver.
Yeah.
Hate the drive.
Hate the game.
All right. Physical effects, right? There are physical effects, too, to all of this. Stress causes physical problems in our body, right, Amy?
Yes, and we know that the more time that people spend commuting, the less likely they are to have time to exercise. And the higher the chances are that they'll experience hypertension, they have lower levels of energy. And so then when you have all of these physical health issues, it compounds the mental health effect because you don't feel well physically, and it increases your stress. And the more stressed you are, the more likely you are to experience health problems. Ugh. And it can turn into this vicious cycle.
This is awful.
That's so bad.
You know, everyone listening to us, or most of the people listening to us, are in their cars right now.
Right.
And they're like, yes.
I'm
feeling worse now. Thank you, KCRW. Amy, is the solution public transportation? Are we calmer when we're taking the train or the bus?
It depends. So there's some studies that found that long commutes, if you're on a train, can be just as harmful because, again, you're not in control. You're not able to get there any faster. But other emerging research has found when you're on the train, you're able to maybe check your phone. It's easier to flip through a podcast and listen to things. You have a little bit of more freedom. So people who are able to use their commute to and turn it into something productive, if they can get work done, they can pull out a laptop or they can pull out their phone and at least respond to emails, they're less likely to be as stressed as other people.
Okay, let's talk solutions now. Jenny, you talked to listeners about how they cope, their coping mechanisms.
Yeah, I talked to a lot of people and a lot of them said, you know, there's just kind of an unwind period that you have to have, whether it's watching TV or doing nothing, but like not immediately going into your next activity. There's just kind of a de-stress.
You mean when you get out of the car, when you get home?
That's right. So once you leave the vehicle and are in the next phase in your house or whatever, there's still kind of a de-stressing that you have to do. I talked to one woman, Lauren Kitching, who says she often watches TV, but her favorite thing to do is eat.
I would go home and like make like a very simple pasta dish or something, and I wouldn't even watch anything while I ate. I would just sit at the countertop and eat, and that was the only way I could kind of get over it. I was like, it's just the madness of like sitting there and just feeling like you're wasting your life and wondering like, should I just move, because this is not worth it.
Wow.
I talked to a lot of people who had lived in Los Angeles and said they moved and traffic was a major reason why.
Wow. Amy, this is all so depressing. Do you have any hope, any way of coping that actually will turn commutes into less painful experiences?
Yes. One thing is to make time for exercise. People who create time, whether they go for a walk or they hit the gym, are less affected by their commutes than other people. So if you're able to build that into your schedule, even if you have a long commute, you'll fare better. And the other trick is to just what you said, to sort of figure out how do you make it so that your commute is more like your unwind time, and what can you do that's enjoyable to you. So if you have a favorite podcast that you listen to, or you just decide you're going to sit back and enjoy the scenery or take some time to yourself to think, then you're much better likely to fare better than somebody who sits in traffic and starts thinking about all the time they're not spending with their family. So it's really important to make sure that you build in enough time outside of your commute that's still good for you. And then during your commute, if you can't change your commute, just make the best of it. Find something that helps you to get through it so that you can enjoy it as much as you possibly can.
I will say, we were talking about how isolating it is to be in the car by yourself. It's a great time to make phone calls and talk to people. Like, I always call my mom on my commute. And also, I hope she's not listening, I can say, okay, I'm home, I gotta go.
Love you, Mom.
There's like a beginning and an end
right,
time.
Right.
It's built in.
It's perfect. I care about you this much.
Well, it is a long commute, so yeah. It's a lot of caring. So, Amy, what about that? Like, any research on that in terms of like actually making connections while you're in the car and making it more pleasant because you're actually having social connections when you're on the phone?
Yes, because one of the things we know is that people who have longer commutes have less time to spend with their friends. Mm-hmm. And so then the less social time that people have, the more likely they are to find their commute straining. And so absolutely, if you're able to safely talk on the phone during your commute, then and you're able to feel like you're using it to your advantage, then anything you can do that can be helpful to you. So I think, yeah, turn that into a time where you feel like you're connecting with people, then you're much better off than somebody who just sits there and stews about how they wish they were able to spend time with their friends.
So, Amy, you don't even live in L.A., but can you empathize with our plight? You live in Florida.
I do, but I go to L.A. maybe a couple of times a year for business events. And I have to say, in the times that I've commuted in L.A. traffic, I can only imagine what it must be like to do that every day. And I'm usually in an Uber or something like that, so I'm able to answer emails and try to get things done.
And you know what's weird? Apparently, what? Our traffic's not the worst.
Whose is the worst?
INRIX, that same traffic mm-hmm. data company, says Boston.
Oh, wow.
Then D.C., Chicago, New York, and then us.
Really?
Which I just can't believe.
No, I don't believe that. That's fake news right there.
That's fake news. Only listen to KCRW for real news.
No, I don't know what they're basing that on, but it just seems, you know, just by experience.
Yeah, it's like amount of time spent in the car and congestion. So I'm sure it's true, but the experience feels like it's not true.
What was your commute like today, Jenny?
You know, fair to Midland. I live pretty close to the station, and I have my like little side routes that I go. Mm-hmm. Can I use this opportunity to vent?
Please.
Okay. So my least favorite thing about drivers in LA is the overhonking. So I find that suddenly we're like New York City and everyone's got a honk. Like the moment the light turns to green, you don't even get a second. People are honking. Or like you leave one car length between you and the car in front of you and the guy behind you is riding you and honking as if, what's he going to do, pass you and get in that little space or go any faster? So I'm like, you need to slow your roll. So over honkers really just...
That gets you.
That gets me.
Okay.
Yeah, that makes me edgy.
I get that.
Yeah.
And that just adds to everyone's stress when people are honking.
Yeah, I mean...
But do you think it relieves the honker's stress? Maybe that's what that is.
I think there's an agitation level, and I think people want control. And yeah, mm-hmm. I do think that honking is just a way to vent. They're looking for instant gratification. I think there's other ways to deal. Right?
Okay.
Am I right?
No, you are totally right. You are absolutely right.
Thanks.
You're always right. Well, what is your favorite strategy for dealing with traffic?
So I'm like you. I feel really good if I've made, you know, a phone call to a friend I haven't mm-hmm. spoken to in a while and kind of had a complete call, like, how are the kids and blah, 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 and all this sort of stuff. Podcasts, my saviors. Mm-hmm. So if I've run out of podcasts, like something I'm binging, that's a bummer. But if I have like a brand new podcast that I have to catch up on a bunch of episodes, I'm like, okay, because, you know, I'm in the field a lot reporting.
Yeah.
So I'll have to do an hour and a half
drive. Or you listen
drive.
To Press Play because that's on podcast.
That is one of my podcasts that never lets me down on a daily basis. So
there we go. We've come up with the key to...
So, and then music.
Stress.
I mean,
I know. Well,
how
today,
about you, Madeline?
Today, you have to have a bumping tune.
Yes.
So, today, on the way in, I listened to this. That is my new favorite, Lizzo, with her single Juice. And that will put a smile on your face.
Lizzo is rocking.
For sure. Okay, I want to thank you both so much. Jenny Hamill, KCRW's intrepid reporter, and Amy Morin, she's a psychotherapist at Northeastern University, author of a lot of books, including 13 Things Mentally Strong Women Don't Do. Thank you, Amy.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jenny.
Thanks, Madeline.
Coming up, the Academy Awards are this Sunday. We'll look at the films nominated in the documentary short category next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Many successful directors, such as George Lucas, Christopher Nolan, they began their careers making short films. But shorts are more than just stepping stones to features. They have a power all their own. Take, for instance, the films nominated this year in each of the often overlooked Oscar shorts categories: live action, animation, documentary. And because we have someone here who knows something about documentaries, we decided to take a closer look at the nominated doc shorts here on Press Play. Matt Holzman is host of the KCRW podcast, The Document, and curator of the documentary screening series, also called The Document. Hi, Matt.
Hello.
Five short docs nominated for an Academy Award, and they range in length from 7 minutes to 40 minutes, which I guess is the longest a short can be to be a short.
Yep. Right? It's actually 40 minutes and about 3 seconds, so I'm not sure how it made it in the category.
Oh,
but,
my gosh. Yeah. Okay. Interesting that extra 3 seconds is important.
I guess.
Well, let's begin with the shortest. It's called A Night at the Garden.
If you ask what we are actively fighting for under our charter, first, a social just white Gentile ruled United States. Second, Gentile-controlled labor union, free from Jewish Moscow-directed domination.
Okay, so this is over old black-and-white footage shot from 1939. It's called The Garden because it takes place in Madison Square Garden. This is a Nazi rally.
An unabashed, unapologetic Nazi rally, although it was called the German-American Bund was the name of the organization. And you just heard Fritz Kuhn, who was the head of the organization, a naturalized citizen, obviously not from these parts. He was from Germany. But it is so heart-stopping to watch this footage in the United States right before the war, and how, you know, the hall, this giant place, looks very much like a Nazi rally with huge Nazi symbols in the back, and also a picture of George Washington. So it's very, the whole thing is very confusing. Mm-hmm. And as you watch it, you can't quite wrap your head around what it is that you're watching.
And how did they get their hands on this footage?
Well, the footage has been around for a while, but Marshall Curry, who directed this film and also was nominated for Oscars for a couple of features, If a Tree Falls and Street Fight, he heard the story, he couldn't believe it, and he went to a couple of different archives and he pulled a bunch of different footage to make this very short film. And I think originally he thought he would have some commentary and some context, but I think after just seeing the raw footage, he realized it had such contemporary resonance in and of itself. You know that classic phrase, "It could never happen here." Mm-hmm. Well, it did. Yeah. It was, and had the war not started when it did, who knows what this group would have accomplished in the United States. Like, there were 20,000 people in Madison Square Garden. It was filled. I can't imagine that there weren't some people who couldn't get tickets or couldn't get a babysitter that night. So there was a lot of people who believed what these people believed. And it's really quite a shocking, very short film.
All right. Next up, another one that deals with racism, but in the United Kingdom, in Essex, to be precise. This one is called Black Sheep.
You're talking about a black kid being accepted by racists, and they were cool with me, like me of all people, and it felt good.
So that's Cornelius Walker, who was the subject of this film, and he was a young kid in England, in London, the son of Nigerian immigrants. A terrible thing happened in London. A kid just like himself was murdered. They think it was racially motivated. His parents decide to move him out of the city. But in moving him out of the city, they move into a neighborhood that is really run by racists. And in order to fit in, he kind of adopts their ways and becomes one of them. And it is a movie that is made with recreation.
How does he become one of them? He becomes a racist?
Well, he doesn't become a racist necessarily, but he becomes very quiet in what he believes and just goes along with what they do. He does a lot of the violence that they did. He takes on a lot of the attitudes. Mm-hmm. He just wanted to be accepted,
yeah.
And had to survive the situation that he was in. And it really, really talks about identity. It talks about complacency. It talks about what it means to keep silent. And also, it does it in a beautifully made way. I mean, this of all the five films is the most cinematic. It has both the interview with this really compelling kid. He's really, really interesting to watch, very thoughtful. And then recreations with mostly non-actors set in the place where things actually happened. So it's a really compelling.
I mean, how do you feel about reenactments as someone who watches documentaries? Do you think that's ethical?
Oh, absolutely. I do. I mean, as long as it's clear that's a recreation, I mean, it's a really powerful tool when used correctly, when mm-hmm. it's used understatedly. And in this case, you know, as long as you're not trying to yeah. create situations that didn't really happen. And in each one of these recreations, it really is just giving you a sense of being there. I think the recreations in this film are amazing.
Okay. That one's called Black Sheep. Next up, we have Lifeboat, about a mission to rescue refugees off the coast of Libya.
The closer you get to the problem, like a car crash or something, then it's not just a mass of people, then they're separating into individuals. And then they've actually got different expressions on their faces. Then you have to start dealing with them as people. And then your heart starts operating more than your head.
Who is that? Who are we hearing from?
So that's John Castle, who was an activist and a captain of a vessel that was purchased by an organization called Sea Watch, a European organization, to basically just go out into the water and find these refugee boats that were coming towards Europe and to try to help them in what was just a terrible situation. He's a remarkable character. He's since passed away. But this is another one in a series of movies over the last couple of years of trying to take us into the immigration and the refugee crisis so you can really see. You know, we talk about it a lot, but we don't see it a lot. And, you know, just so you get an idea of the scope of the thing, Sea Watch, this one small organization, has pulled, I think it says in the film that over the course of 3 days, they pulled 3,200 people from the sea.
Oh, my gosh.
So, and they're doing a very tiny bit. You know, they're doing what they can. And that's kind of what John Castle says throughout this film, which is, you know, this is not solving the problem, but we couldn't stand by and do nothing.
All right, let's talk about another one called Endgame. This is about, well, end of life, how we die. Wow, these are uplifting movies we're talking about here.
Welcome to documentaries.
The film follows several terminal patients in the Bay Area, one named Mitra. Here is her husband and mother.
There is no hope.
Then I don't know.
Ask her. She can answer.
Okay, and if she cannot talk?
Then you have to decide.
Okay, and but
then it's not true.
So we're not going to let her go. Do you want to let her go? Is she inconvenient for people?
No, just I don't want to see her like that. She's suffering.
This is an absolutely heart-wrenching movie, but also very beautiful in its own way. And the point, one of the points of the movie really is that these are things we need to talk about. We need to bring them out of the shadows. And you realize in watching the process of not only people dying, but their loved ones dealing with it, that there is a certain beauty and poignancy to it. And the fact that what causes death, part of what causes death to be so painful is that we don't confront it head on. And the medical professionals who are in this movie, and there's a couple of doctors who are featured prominently, the way they handle it, I mean, they ask these questions that are so direct, but they do it in such a loving way. And you know, you can only hope that you will have a death that is as meaningful as the death that you see in this film. But I will tell you, a box of Kleenex is advised.
Sounds like it.
Yeah.
Last, we have something a little more uplifting. We're going to end on an uplifting movie. This one's called Period, End of Sentence. And it's about trying to help women and girls when they're menstruating and give them something very simple, something we take for granted here, sanitary pads. So here's a clip from a man who invented a sanitary napkin machine.
The daughter never talked to mother. The wife never talked to husband. Friends, they don't talk each other. Menstruation is the biggest taboo in my country. I'm Arunachalam Murugananda, man who invented the low-cost sanitary napkin machine. Our mission is creating India into 100% napkin using country from the current level of less than 10%.
Okay, he says he wants to turn India into a 100% napkin-using country from the current level of less than 10%.
Right. Now, it is a really uplifting film because it has a very strong kind of girl power message. I will say it's also really, really frustrating because you have a country where this subject is taboo. Mm-hmm. And the idea that women don't have access to good sanitary napkins is like was a bit of an eye-opener for me. But he's created this machine, and really the story is that these women, these girls are going to make sanitary napkins, and they're going to be able to sell them at low cost to women, especially in rural areas who don't have access to them, and it's going to change their lives. It seems kind of like, well, what's the big deal? And the big deal is you can't go to school.
Right, exactly.
If you don't
if you're
have...
on your period and you can't
that's
staunch
right.
the blood.
That's exactly right. So it has it's a real serious impact. And also it's an opportunity for these women to make money, to create a business, and to also empower other women.
That sounds great.
Yeah. And it's kind of interesting because it has kind of a local genesis, this story, because kids at the Oakwood School started this project in order to send machines out. Now, again, when he says pad machine, it makes pads. It doesn't vend them. You don't put a quarter in and get one. And so they started this project and decided it was interesting enough that they wanted to make a documentary about it. They raised some money, hence the documentary. They are not included.
So wait, the girls at Oakwood made the documentary?
Well, essentially they did. Yeah. And the woman who's the head of this program at Oakwood is one of the producers of the film.
Oh.
And to their credit, I have to say, it really is a fun and interesting and kind of shocking film. They are not really in the movie. And the fact that they decided that that's how they would make the movie is a real credit to them, I think.
Is there something to be achieved in a short documentary that you cannot achieve in a longer standard form documentary?
Well, I will say that, you know, shortness does require that you get to the point and that you make an impact quickly. And there are a lot of documentaries, and I think we can both agree on this, that, you know, you think to yourself, boy, that could have been 45 minutes shorter.
Yep.
And so there's that. And I think about the short film about Joseph Kony that came out a few years ago, and it had a gigantic impact because it had an ability to be spread virally. So the idea that a 7 or 10 minute documentary can be spread virally, it has a real opportunity for impact that feature films don't.
Well, Matt, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Matt Holzman, host of KCRW's The Document. Hi, Christian Bordahl.
Hey there, Matt.
Last few seconds of the show, you snuck
yes,
in.
Yes, we have lots of people talking about the terrors of traffic today because that was something that we came across
Completely.
Earlier. Pat Dragotta says she deals with it with audiobooks. She says, I drive from Studio City to 3rd Street Promenade in Santa Monica and back 5 days a week. Sometimes it's a 4-hour day. Without audiobooks, I would not survive. And let's see here. The Mac guy just says, by moving to Portland. So I guess that's, that's one way to deal with it. Anyway, lots of people had something to say about traffic, not surprisingly.
Not surprisingly. All right. Well, best of luck in traffic. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. Barbara Bogave is here tomorrow. I'll see you on Monday.